Thank you. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. I wanted to do that quickly in order to apologize to folks that I am now going to step out of the room for a few moments. I have to be next door right now, or I'm being upstaged by six school children who are testifying on my bill. So, we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3021. And Mr. Molina is going to brief us, and our good Vice Chair, Representative Freeman, will carry on for a few moments. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3021 revises laws relating to emergencies and emergency responders. It designates qualified emergency service volunteers, health care providers, health care facilities, operators of emergency health care centers, and search and rescue volunteers to serve as agents of a public body under the Oregon Tort Claims Act during a declared emergency event. It further provides for appropriate workers' compensation coverage. And I, to clarify for the committee, there's an amendment in here, you'll see. It basically clarifies the sections of the bill, and those are all based upon the Oregon Law Commission. And there's some reorganization that you'll notice in Chapter 401 to be more user-friendly. And I'll leave it there.
Okay. Chair Freeman? Very good. I see the first couple we have up is Lane Chatterley and Greg McPherson, and we'll do this a couple at a time.
Former representatives.
Both of them.
Oh, you're right, absolutely. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good to be with you today. For the record, Lane Chatterley, formerly a state legislator and now private practice in my law office over in Dallas. But I'm here today to testify before you in support of House Bill 3021. And my role will be just briefly to introduce the Oregon Law Commission to you, since this is coming to you as a product of the Oregon Law Commission. Typically, our bills from the commission end up in front of one of the judiciary committees, and it's not often that we get to appear in front of one of the other policy committees, and so I wanted to take just a minute to introduce the commission to you, how we work, and then turn it over to Representative McPherson to walk you through the bill. The Oregon Law Commission was created by the legislature in 1997. And it was statutorily tasked to undertake an ongoing program of law improvement and law revision. And at the time that it was created, was the membership of the commission was identified as being two members appointed by the House Speaker, two members appointed by the Oregon Senate President, a member appointed by the Governor, four members appointed by the Oregon State Bar Association, the deans of Oregon's three law schools, the Attorney General, and the Chief Justice of Oregon's Supreme Court. The commission has been in existence now for 11 years. We are a product of what has evolved as a very successful partnership with Willamette University, whereby the state provides funding and support through the Office of Legislative Counsel, and Willamette University provides office space, staffing, and other support for the commission. Over the years, the Oregon Law Commission has introduced and successfully passed between 50 and 60 bills, and I'm pleased to say that the commission has become known as something of a go-to place for some of the thornier issues that need to be resolved. We take up projects sometimes on recommendation from judges, sometimes from lawyers around the state. More and more we're getting requests from the legislature itself to deal with issues that the legislature has identified that need the particular kind of work that we do, and we also receive requests from the governor's office and state agencies. This bill came to us initially on request through the Department of Human Services, but also jointly with the Governor's Office, the Office of Emergency Management, and then we pulled together the resources in a task force, a drafting committee that brings in practitioners from around the state with the various areas of expertise, and in that drafting process, that committee develops legislation which then goes to the full Oregon Law Commission, and on review and approval by the commission is authorized for introduction to the legislature. And so that is how this bill got to you, dealing with a problem that was identified initially by Department of Human Services, but then worked through that very extensive work group process. Representative McPherson, who is also a member with me of the commission, was chair or co-chair of co-chair with Senator Prezansky. Greg Mao.
Yeah.
That's right. Greg Mao, an attorney up in Portland, co-chairs of this work group. We thought this might be a long-term project, and frankly, we were pleased and surprised at how quickly it came together on the major issues to be able to introduce it to you as House Bill 3021. The last thing I would say is we have staff from the commission with us today, Christy Nielsen, Jeff Dobbins, who is our executive director, and also deputy director and general counsel, Wendy Johnson, is with us in the room today. So it's my pleasure to spend a few minutes with you just introducing you to the Oregon Law Commission and the value that it brings to your process, and I'm happy to turn it over to Representative McPherson to walk you through the elements of House Bill 3021. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lane. Vice Chair Freeman and members of the committee, for the record, I am Greg McPherson, former state representative and continuing member of the Oregon Law Commission. And it was my pleasure and privilege to serve as the co-chair of the work group of the Law Commission that developed this proposal. On our work group, actually, Chair Cowan was a member of that work group and participated actively, and we drew a good deal of important guidance from her perspectives. with apologies to the state of Tennessee, I think that Oregon should be, rather than Tennessee, should be called the volunteer state. We depend so much on our volunteers to get things done for the public good in the state. And fortunately, we are blessed that many of our citizens come forward and volunteer their time and energies when we are at times of emergency to get things done that have to be done. People step up in the state as a general matter. And we need to assure that that continues to happen. And the focus of the charge that was made to the work group that I co-chaired and the work that the Law Commission brought forward is to look to see what kinds of obstacles could impair the ability of the state to draw on the volunteer services of Oregonians. And in our work, we focused on two areas. One of those is the risk of liability that people have when they volunteer their efforts and they do things in times of tension and hazard. What kinds of liability might they be subjected to? We had offered up to us lots of ideas about how to limit the exposure, that is, the risk of being sued, and those run squarely into a principle that's been established by the Oregon Supreme Court under the Remedies Clause of the Oregon Constitution, which states that remedies available to people shall not be impaired or limited, and that has been interpreted by the court as preserving any remedy that was available at the time of statehood in 1859, 150 years ago, unless there is an adequate substitute remedy provided. And it's on that basis that you have been considering recently a broader bill that I was actually involved in formulating to amend our Oregon Tort Claims Act to assure that we have a broader substitute remedy so that the Tort Claims Act would be more effective providing rights to Oregonians. Our work group and the Oregon Law Commission then focused on the what appear to be coming out in that area to see how we could work with that in areas of emergency circumstances. And what we concluded is that any attempt to try to limit access to the courts by somebody who believes they were injured by somebody acting in an emergency situation would run squarely into that principle as established by the Oregon Supreme Court. So instead, what this bill does is it clarifies the applicability of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which already by its terms requires that public entities indemnify anyone who is an agent of a public entity. And so we took that principle and tried and refined it by establishing when is somebody acting as an agent of the public entity. And we focused particularly on the areas of search and rescue and emergency health services, because that's where the greatest concerns tend to emerge. And what this bill does is it clarifies and makes more precise those circumstances in which an individual who volunteers themselves, particularly in the areas of search and rescue and emergency health services, when they will be deemed to be an agent of the public entity and therefore entitled to a defense and indemnification and the limits on recovery that the Tort Claims Act provides. And for those of you who voted recently on the Tort Claims Act revision, in general what it does is it establishes a per-claim limit of $1.5 million for the state and one-third of that amount, $500,000, for local governments, which apply to any liability that arises both against the public entity and against the employees and agents of that public entity. So the attempt is to try to make more precise so that volunteers know when they're covered and when they're not, when the public entity they're volunteering themselves for stands behind them and will defend them and indemnify them, and when they're on their own. And one of the realities is that there are a lot of well-meaning citizens who will show up in a time of emergency, and it's not necessarily appropriate for the public entity to be undertaking responsibility for everything that those individuals might do. So what the bill does is it requires that only people who are qualified and have gone through a process that has been pre-established or who are acknowledged in writing as being the agent of the public entity will be entitled to that defense. The other area of concern is workers' compensation, that is, people who themselves might be injured as they undertake to provide volunteer services. And it's got a parallel set of issues, that is, that we want to make sure that people who have put themselves at risk in a way that is to the public benefit do have workers' comp coverage, but there is a potential cost, in fact, probably actual cost to that, to public entities, and so we need to control those circumstances. So again, it's people who are qualified and accepted by the public entity, either the state in a circumstance of a governor-declared emergency or local government acting as well. So what we think we've done here is to achieve a proper balance between the protections both from liability and, in this case of injury, for people who volunteer their time, as balanced with the need of our public entities, both the state and our local governments, to make sure that they're not just putting at too broad risk the treasuries that we depend on for all our other public services. So that, in broad concept, is what this proposed legislation does, and there are others here from the staff of the Oregon Law Commission who could speak into more to the details of the proposal. But I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Do we have any questions for this panel? Well, you described it very well because it's pretty complicated. So thank you for coming today, and we appreciate your work on this, and we'll hear from some other people. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you very much.
I think next we're going to have Dr. Grant Higgins and Director Ken Murphy come up. And while they're coming up, I hear a little bit of buzzing on our sound system. We need to have everybody to turn their cell phone off. And if Vibrate doesn't get it done, we need to try to have them turned off or it messes with the sound system. The other thing real quick is we have scheduled 45 minutes for this testimony, so if you could keep it like 4 minutes or so, would be great.
Chair Freeman, I will try to keep this very short. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 3021. This is a bill, as you've just heard, that was proposed by the Oregon Law Commission at the request of the Department and the Office of Emergency Services. I think for all of us, we know that since September 11, 2001, states have really recognized that one of the critical responsibilities of state government and local government is to protect the safety and well-being of its citizens. Due to the fact that disasters quickly overwhelm local resources and government resources, we rely heavily on the private sector as well as what we can pull together at the state and local government level. on the health care side of things, we have heard significant concerns being raised about liability issues and concerns that would make health care providers question whether or not they would be willing to participate in response activities should there be an emergency or a disaster. Last session, the health department, health division, was actually very successful in getting some bills passed that dealt with public health emergencies and other disaster scenarios. However, one place that we did not make any progress was the whole issue of liability and immunity for health care providers. It's very, very clear in these financially troubled times that the state does not want to take on additional risks. However, on the other hand, it's equally clear that the state has to be able to mount a response for disasters when they occur, and to do that, we need to make sure there are willing volunteers and willing participants. And so the department believes that a balanced approach, and one that is clearly stated in statute, is something that we need at this time. So to achieve that goal, it was our idea to take this concept to the Oregon Law Commission. They were interested in this as we talked further, particularly with the governor's office and the Oregon Emergency Management Division. We thought that it needed to be broader than just for healthcare providers, and so the Law Commission took a look at all emergency responders, not just healthcare responders. The commission did take this up. We're very grateful for the work that they've done, appreciate the staff work, the work group members, the commission itself, and again, the department is strongly in support of this bill. It doesn't do everything that needs to be done. It's an ongoing process, but I think that it does some very good things and makes us a stronger state. Thank you. Be happy to answer questions now or at the end, because Law Commission staff will be coming to talk more details in a minute.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Freeman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy, the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, a division of the Oregon Military Department, and I sit on the sub-working group with Dr. Higginson and many other members, and incredibly educational experience, and I do want to thank Lane Chatterley and the Law Commission for all their efforts on this. Even though we got to this point, we had many, many hours of discussions because these do touch upon significant issues about the protection of, as Dr. Higginson said, not only our citizens and the visitors of the state, but what I think is equally important is the protection of the volunteers that stand up in our communities across this state every single day. I'm fully in support of this bill. Clearly, there's some issues here that need to be discussed and further fleshed out. But primarily, other than what Dr. Higginson talked about with health volunteers in the portions of the business that I deal with, not only with volunteers in health, but we also have community emergency response teams. We have many different volunteer organizations like the Fire Corps that provides volunteers to fire departments or cities, police corps. We have even volunteers for veterinarians that will come to a scene. And many other groups, and just general citizens that come to disasters or events to help out because it's in their nature and in their heart to help people in trouble. So I think the basic premise of addressing the issues of volunteers is something that we truly need to do. I also think as you read through this bill, it clearly talks about during a governor's declared emergency, in which I think is important. It also really advocates that the emergency management community, public safety in general, be more proactive to register volunteers ahead of time, determine their qualifications, give them training if appropriate, so that we have these people readily available to us. I would be less than honest, during a declared disaster or any event, you're still going to have what we call the emergent volunteer. I just stopped by and looks like fun, I want to help. That is something that's hard to control, but there are things that we can put in place to do that. But I think for those people that have taken the time to volunteer, learn arts and crafts and skills, to go help our citizens, I think this bill addresses those issues to try and answer, are they covered if they're working for a city, county, or the state of Oregon? And then also, it clearly one of the most active events that doesn't require a governor's declaration of emergency is search and rescue. Happens every single day in Oregon, two or three times a day in Oregon, whether it's looking for somebody with dementia, a lost child, somebody climbing Mount Hood, or somebody just hiking in our beautiful state. Happens quite often, and many, even though our county sheriffs are responsible for search and rescue in each one of our counties and do have some paid personnel, they rely heavily on volunteers. So I think, especially in that particular community, it's very important that this bill is here to try and address those issues, to help them in what they spend an incredible amount of their personal time and personal money to learn their skills to go save people that they don't know. So, again, I think there is a great deal of good policy in here about how we address these issues. Clearly, I'm sure there'll be more discussion on the financial issues and the potential, but I think for a policy issue, dealing with the volunteers of our state, no matter what they do, it is a positive and a correct thing to take a look at, and how we not only protect them, but further make this effort, which I always consider, we call this mitigation, doing something before the event happens. And I think this is the right thing to do to address those issues. And I'll answer any questions now or later.
Okay, questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Ken, just going through this, and sorry for not getting to this before I came to the committee and everything, but I'm almost wondering if we might be missing something by not including in declared emergencies where we declude hospitals and medical facilities that are in place as well, because they're going to be dealing with a lot of people coming in at one time, and they should have some protection, and we're not including them where I can find it in here. I went through it, I think on page 14 right now, but...
And Chair Freeman and Representative Widener, it is included in the bill, and in fact it starts on sections 7 through 9. There actually were some provisions for healthcare providers and hospitals previous to this. At the way it is currently in statute, it would only apply if they volunteered. And one of the big parts for me in this bill is that now it allows them to become agents of the state, regardless of whether or not they're being compensated, which I think is something that we needed to see happen. So that is being addressed.
Actually, I got it right there. 9 hits a lot of it. Okay.
Yep.
Great. Any other questions of these folks? Great. Thank you guys for your testimony. We'll have up next Dr. Ross Fleshman and Rob Cruikshank.
Good afternoon. I'm Ross Fleischman, the emergency physician with Portland Mountain Rescue. House Bill 3021 will save local governments money by supporting volunteer search and rescue. It will clarify our protection from personal legal liability and will rightly extend workers' compensation to volunteers who are injured performing these necessary services to your constituents. And while daring rescues on Mount Hood receive the most media attention, they're just a tiny part of what search and rescue does for the well-being of Oregonians. We find lost children and Alzheimer's patients. We assist law enforcement finding criminal evidence. And we help those who become lost in more common outdoor pursuits, such as hiking. As search and rescue is already a legal obligation of the counties, search and rescue costs and liability related to that would likely fall to the counties with or without House Bill 3021. This bill merely improves many of the contradictory, unclear, and potentially unenforceable provisions of current law. And as search and rescue is an obligation of the counties, search and rescue volunteers save our government an extraordinary amount of money by providing these services without pay. Portland Mountain Rescue's nearly 100 volunteers give thousands of hours of service annually, saving hundreds of thousands of dollars to local governments. As we provide a professional-level service, including physicians, paramedics, and rescue experts, adequate liability protection is an important issue for us. The cost of extending workers' compensation to coverage to volunteers is small compared to the value of the free service that we provide. It's also the right thing to do. Even though I carry personal medical and disability insurance, the mountaineering exclusion on my disability policy would leave me and my family uncovered if I were hurt during a rescue on Mount Hood. It's only fair that while carrying out the work of the county, I should receive the same type of coverage as would a sheriff's deputy who was injured in the line of duty. While this does impose an obligation on local governments, the majority of sheriffs are already providing some degree of medical or disability coverage for their volunteers. So in summary, House Bill 3021 would continue to ensure a cost savings to local government by supporting volunteer search and rescue, will clarify our protection from legal liability, and will rightly extend workers' compensation coverage for volunteers who become injured while performing this valuable service for your constituents. On behalf of Portland Mountain Rescue, I urge you to support House Bill 3021. Thank you.
Thank you. Go
ahead. Vice Chair Freeman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Cruikshank. I'm a volunteer with Pacific Northwest Search and Rescue. I had the opportunity to sit as an advisor to the work group that put together this proposed legislation. And again, I would like to speak in support of House Bill 3021, specifically sections 11 through 14, which deals with our area of search and rescue. I have been involved in the search and rescue community for 8 years now. In those 8 years, I have been on 108 missions, out finding all kinds of people, injuries, body recovers, all kinds of things. Every time I go out, there are two things in the back of my mind. Am I going to get sued, or what happens if I get hurt? Things can go wrong out there, and you never know what a subject or their family is likely to do if something goes wrong. So far, I have not been sued, thankfully. On November 28th of this last year, we did find out what happens if we get hurt. And in our case, we found out the system is not really working well that is in place that we have. My wife and I were part of a multi-agency training with Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. In the course of the training, my wife fell and broke her ankle. So far, the medical bills have been $28,215, with more still in the system. Our personal insurance, fortunately we had personal insurance, picked up a majority of those bills. We still had over $3,000 in copays and deductibles and all this stuff that wasn't covered. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, who we routinely volunteer with, we're based in Clackamas County, carries a volunteer insurance coverage with a limit of $25,000. It's considered a secondary coverage. Everything else that you may have as a volunteer is supposed to pay the cost if you get hurt. They do not have any provision for disability. My wife is a early childhood education teacher. She needs to be on her feet all the time. She was off work for 14 weeks. She just went to back work full-time 2 weeks ago. County insurance carrier is paying some of the bills. We're still working to get some of them paid. But my wife did not have disability insurance. So that 14 weeks that she was off due to an accident and training is on our tab. If my wife had been an employee of the sheriff's office, it's a very good chance you would have had complete medical coverage, disability. Everything is afforded to the sheriff's deputies who are out there doing essentially the same work as we are, the search and rescue sheriff's office. A little bit of perspective on the individual costs that some of the volunteers, in my case, I'll give you my numbers, invest to the state of Oregon, to the citizens of Oregon. In 2008, my wife and I invested 753 hours to searches, training, and other related search and rescue activities, children's fairs, education things, teaching kids about how not to get lost, all that kind of stuff. We pay for our own equipment. We pay for all of our own fuel. I drove 3,267 miles to searches and trainings this last year. In our particular case, we have a direct loss of $5,320 in lost wages for my wife. That's just part of our cost of volunteering. In the past 8 years that I've been involved with Pacific Northwestern Search and Rescue, we have been called to 13 counties in Oregon and three in Washington to provide search and rescue assistance to the various sheriff's departments that need our assistance. When we respond to other counties, we don't know if or what coverage they may have. We know what Clackamas County has. I know what Multnomah County and Washington County provides. But the other nine counties that we've gone to, I have no idea if we have coverage at all when we go there. We respond to calls, and when we respond to calls in Washington, they provide portal to portal. When we leave our house, we're covered till we get home with their disability insurance. House Bill, the provisions in House Bill 3021 really, I think, remedy some of the concerns that we have. It gives us a clear definition of what a search and rescue volunteer is. Many times when I talk to people, they think, well, we're covered by the Good Samaritan Act. Well, that's really not true in Oregon because we're not medical providers, and that's pretty much what the Good Samaritan Act does, describes in Oregon as the coverage of a dentist or a doctor or a veterinarian. So it kind of gives us a legal definition of why we're out there, what gives us a legal right to be out there. Section 13 really provides for some liability protections by making us agents of the county. We're in a very litigious society where you can sue for just about anything. And one of our great fears is the subject may not like the way they got rescued or their family or something caused discomfort or, we don't know what. By extending the immunity or the immunization of the county to the volunteers really helps to shield us from that, I think. The other issue I think is very important to the volunteers of this state regarding with search and rescue is the provision for workers' compensation and liability coverage or injury protections. And a couple of reasons that the system we have now has some problems. Some of our volunteers in our group especially, and I can't speak for all, have very limited medical insurance or very high deductibles. It'd be catastrophic if they had something more serious than a broken ankle or an accident. And $25,000 cap on a coverage is not going to do them very well. As Dr. Fleischman mentioned, private insurance carriers such as Aflac has very specific exclusions. Mountaineering, use of ropes or other devices, you're excluded from coverage if you get hurt. We've done a lot of body recoveries and rescues where ropes are required. We don't get ourselves in those situations. We go to try to recover people that have gotten there. So going in there with that possibility of being excluded, to have your coverage excluded because of that, is the wrong policy. And again, without disability insurance, injured searchers can face a very severe financial hardship. We are fortunate in our case, my wife was able to go back to work relatively soon, and it didn't hurt her too bad. It hurt us too bad. Another thing that has come up from time to time is we have a hard time getting resources from across the river to come into Oregon to help. There are two letters from Washington organizations that should be in your reference pack. One from Tacoma Mountain Rescue, more specifically dealing with issues on Mount Hood, and one from John Carlson from Wind River Search and Rescue. Both organizations and have reservations of coming to Oregon because of this liability, or they're prevented from their group managers from coming over here because they won't expose their members to uncertain insurance or liability issues. So with that, I will thank you for the opportunity. I would again encourage you to support this bill and pass it through, and I would be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for your assistance, Representative Freeman. Are there any questions for these individuals? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just while you're sitting here, folks, and to everybody out there, I just want to say thanks to both your organizations and to you individually, obviously, for the commitment you make and dedication to helping our constituents and your fellow Oregonians and, in some case, Washington residents, too. Several of my friends are part of the Portland Mountain Rescue. I know how dedicated both your organizations are and how much time you put into doing what you do. So thanks very much for spending time testifying today, and thanks for bringing this forward for us. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming. And I think that this would be a good point to recognize that we do have the letter from the Tacoma Mountain Rescue in front of us, and that we will add that, mention it for the record as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will move now to Professor Caroline Farrell. Why don't we have Wendy Johnson and Christy Nielsen come up at the same time? Is Christy here also? Yeah. Yes, no?
She's sick.
No, she's sick. Oh, okay. All right. Sorry, I'm going to track correctly here then. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Cowan, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. You should have in your materials for the hearing, and I also dropped them off at your office, a summary of this long bill as well as the commission's report. Professor Farrell and our staff worked on that report that you have before you. That's one of the unique things about the Oregon Law Commission is we always show our work of how we got to the bill before you. And so we'll be walking through the highlights, the one-pager, wanting to be respectful of your time commitments today, but it's that highlights of HB 3021 that we'll be going through. Professor Farrell at the University of Oregon Law School teaches torts, and among other things, and she'll be starting with that first section.
Yep, I guess that's why I'm talking about liability. So thank you for hearing us today, and a lot of what I'm saying is really going over what former Representative Greg Burson already talked about. He did a very good job, I think, of outlining a lot of what
Professor, for the record, if we could have you put your name on the
yes,
tape.
Yes, it's Caroline Farrell.
Thank you.
So the concern that people have who are volunteers is that they'll be sued. And I think they're really more concerned that they'll be sued than they'll be found liable. There's been very few, if any, suits, and certainly we certainly heard from the tort lawyers that it's not really that likely they're going to be found liable. But that concern exists anyway. And I think considering the kind of work they do, it's important for us to make clear what I would argue already is the rule, which is that they are agents of the state and therefore covered by the Oregon Torts Claims Act. And so that's really what this part of the statute, proposed statute, would do, is it would clarify that they are agents and then who are agents. And I think that's very important that we now say it, you have to be qualified. In order to be qualified, there has to be some written record that you are an agent, that you have been registered prior to the emergency, you've been acknowledged in writing by the public body in charge at the time of the emergency, or if you're a member of the Oregon State Defense Force, if it's the governor declared state of emergency or the public health emergency. Similarly, for the search and rescue, there's a specific things you have to satisfy in order to be qualified. And again, registered with the Office of Emergency Management, registered with the sheriff to conduct such a search, a member of a registered search and rescue organization, or acknowledged in writing so that there will be some clear evidence. And so there was this mention that there would be some people who, they're just going to show up, they will. And they might even do a good job. But if they don't do a good job, they won't be covered because they won't be agents. They will not have satisfied this. It is to encourage people to be qualified and for the state and the local, the counties to know who, in fact, are those people. And I think that's a very important thing that this bill is going to accomplish, because I think it's already pretty clear that they are agents, and it also just makes that clear so they know. They can sleep at night. They can feel okay going out and saying, well, that person didn't seem as happy with me as I thought they'd be, considering I saved their life. But nevertheless, I know that if they decide to sue me, I will be represented by the state, and I really won't have to worry about that. That will not be my concern. So I think that's a really important aspect of this, and I'm really pleased we're going to do this. The other thing is that it's very clear, and we've made it very clear in the statute, that the only time that they will be covered is if they are acting in the scope of the of their activities that are the activities for which they're qualified and been asked under the emergency situation to deal with. So I think that what we have here is pretty good.
Thank you. Wendy, did you want to add to that? Okay,
Just
wanted to see if you wanted to add anything first. Okay, questions?
Thanks, Madam Chair. with the person, the volunteer who just shows up, for example, say if Representative Matthews as a Portland firefighter responded to an MBA in my district and offered to help,
uh-huh.
would he be covered on that call?
Well, I think he'd be covered if he was, I think you can even do it after the fact. You can say that this person was somebody you...
Not after the fact, but they set up the scene.
Let's make it sure. Yeah, okay. So acknowledged in writing by the public body. So if they show up and they're acknowledged, that would be sufficient.
Follow up? I guess I don't understand the acknowledged. What's
that? So someone shows up that isn't one of the people that are already registered or already a member of this Oregon State Defense Force or one of these other things. The folks in charge who are either of the governor declared state of emergency or the public health emergency or in the counties, the sheriffs, could acknowledge right then on the spot that this person is covered, that this person is qualified.
Then follow up again.
Follow up?
If that incident does not include a sheriff or a sheriff's deputy, just the fire department, for example, a volunteer fire department, and someone, this happens, I'm saying this because it happens a lot on a state highway, et cetera, and someone from another agency somewhere else in the state shows up, says, hi, I'm a paramedic with the Burns Fire Department. Mm-hmm. Do you need help? Yeah. And so how does that work?
I'm going to pass that on.
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, this bill is focused on governor-declared emergencies and governor-declared public health emergencies as well as search and rescue. I think the situation you're talking about is not a declared emergency, nor is it search and rescue. And so then we would be back to the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which covers employees and agents of the state. The problem in existing law is agent is not defined, and there's been litigation on what an agent is. And basically, you need direction by government and some sort of control to be qualify as an agent. So many circumstances, Representative Matthews would be covered if, you know, he was being directed to do certain things and he was an agent. He would have that Tort Claims Act protection. This is clearing up a specific area, which is doesn't happen very often, but it's that declared big emergency. We need to have a process in place ahead of time so people know what the rules are. We did not get into the smaller emergencies, which are in local government's control, and that's still up to the Tort Claims Act or procedures that each county or city develops.
Okay, I have to ask, so this can go further. Search and rescue, it turns into search and rescue. Hikers lost on a mountain. Do the local responders have to be pre-registered? Is that what you're saying? In order to be able to enjoy the services of the state's tort protection?
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, I'll direct you to page 4 of the bill, line 4. There are several ways to qualify, and the catch-all would be acknowledged in writing as a qualified search and rescue volunteer by the Office of Emergency Management or by a sheriff at the scene of a search or rescue. So you can sign up at the scene, but it's got to be okayed by the sheriff or there are provisions for a designation, I believe.
Okay, thank you. If I might, I did serve on the work group that helped to develop this. And there was a lot of conversation around all of the various things that one might get into. There was a decision to kind of stay out of the Good Samaritan law, which is actually has to do with individuals who have qualifications and might happen upon a scene, and was focused more on those particular emergent times when people sort of just step up to help. And Representative Boone, you've described many of those kinds of events, and to find a way to sort of figure out who all is there at the scene and who all is working towards this and give them some protection. So this isn't as broad as it might be. It is a little more narrowly defined, if I remember the discussions of the committee correctly. But and I is that fair to say?
Representative Cowan, yes. That's essentially, as Professor Ferrellis explained, a big chunk of the bill is regarding tort liability, but it's tort liability with respect to search and rescue and governor-declared emergencies. I'd be happy to go through the rest of the bill, which has to focus on workers' comp and some other cleanups.
If there's specific questions, but I don't want... I am cognizant of time.
I know. I'm looking at the clock, too.
Okay. Did you have further questions?
I can talk to her later.
So. Okay. Fine. I think maybe we can arrange some time that would be helpful to get it clarified. Are there any other questions on this bill today?
Yes. Chair Cowan, if I could, I don't think there's much been made of the health care facilities provisions, and I know there's opposition to that section, so if I could go over that, perhaps opposition to that section.
Please.
Section 7 through 9 of the bill deal with health care facilities. During a declared emergency, the Department of Human Services has authority to direct those facilities on protocols and procedures and on things. And so there was a minor amendment to those sections, and it's in Section 9. The law as it is presently provides that those healthcare providers, if they're registered...
Which line? Sorry.
It's all of Section 9. It's the bold language is new. Originally, if those healthcare providers were registered and they were volunteers, they were considered agents of the state for the purposes of claims arising out of those services. It was very broad language. Basically, if there was a declared emergency and they're a healthcare provider, they were considered agents of the state. This bill would narrow it and only, and it's starting on line 18 and also on line 26 is similar language. If it was pursuant to directions from a public body without regard to whether the health care provider is compensated. So that pursuant to directions from a public body limits that Tort Claims Act protection. So it's not just during emergency, now all these facilities are agents of the state. It's if they're acting pursuant to directions of a public body. So if there was a restriction on who you could give ventilators to, for example, or how you should go about providing vaccines, if the state issued those directives, and then the alleged suit was regarding those actions, those would be pursuant to directions, then that Tort Claims Act protection would kick in. You'll see on line 17 that the without compensation, also on line 25, the without compensation has been deleted. During an emergency, nobody's checking insurance cards at the door and knowing whether or not you're going to actually get paid for those people that you're treated. And so it's a balance. The state is not liable for all the actions of a hospital facility during an emergency just because it happens to be during an emergency, but it's those pursuant to direction. But at the same time, it's not like the rest of the bill, which is about a volunteer. This doesn't matter whether the hospital is compensated for treating a particular person. If the hospital no longer has control, in a sense, the government's telling them how to do it, then they will become agents.
And did I hear you say that there was an amendment for that, or you were just basically highlighting what changes to existing law?
I was highlighting the changes to existing law.
Okay, I just
want
to make sure. I didn't hear you incorrectly.
The Dash 1 amendments are recommended by the commission, and I could explain those in greater detail, but they are explained in the report, incorporates the whole thing, because, frankly, the amendments track what the commission is recommending to you, but because of the timing, filing deadlines for dropping the bill, the amendments weren't completed. So they are a whole package, the amendments and the bill. And the amendments mostly focus on just cleaning up compensation and training throughout to make sure that we're covering training, but only training if it's government-approved training, and we're making sure that compensation doesn't include, like, if you pay somebody's lunch or you're, you know, providing pizza to everybody at the scene. Normally in workers' comp law, that's compensation, and that would kick you out of the ability to have that workers' comp in the procedure that we're using, so we had to clean that up a bit.
And I believe part of the conversation in the committee meetings was also around the fact that there may be directives in major emergency situations that require healthcare facilities to sort of treat en masse, mm-hmm. and perhaps I'm being very careful trying not to say any substandard care, but someone with an injury that's not life-threatening might not get the same attention in as timely a manner as they would in normal circumstances. And so
triage.
It is called triage, and there was an attempt to help folks understand that occasionally those facilities come under the direction of the state as to what they have to do, and this is a protection afforded to them. Representative Booth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I made a note of that because I thought I heard you say if you're acting in pursuant to the directives of the state, that there are times when the state then directs, and I just have this scene in my mind in an emergency department of a mass trauma, 16 patients, for example, in Seaside Hospital, which has 6 beds. And then the state can come in and tell them how to triage, or because the hospital would have their own triage policies in place.
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, this is not my area of expertise, but the work group actually made a conscious choice not to change the standard of care required. The circumstances at the scene factor into whether the tort's been committed. So if there are 16 people, the standard of care is still the same, but those circumstances affect whether or not there's been a tort. And so we're not changing that. It's just that there are certain protocols that the state may issue. And you're right, Representative Boone, that these hospitals already have in place their own protocols and such, but the state could also impose directives. And if it's those directions that the hospital is following, then they do become agents of the state for those purposes.
There are special circumstances in emergencies. If there are no other specific questions, then we will bring this back again when people have had a chance to look at it, and I'm assuming that you'll be here to answer any questions that come up at that point. So, thank you. I have one more person scheduled to testify, J. Michael Alexander.
Representative Cowan, members of the committee, my name is Mick Alexander. I go by Mick. I'm a local lawyer, and I'm a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm here on behalf of them. I'm a member of the legislative committee. My concerns really mirror some of the discussion that we just had with regard to emergency health care services. Actually, Representative Widener, we're probably exactly focused in the same area but on opposite sides of the fence. And part of the explanation sort of triggers what I feel is a problem. Number one, should there be an attempted immunity in this situation when we have compensated people? I listen to a lot of stirring information about volunteers, but these people are obviously not volunteers because it doesn't make any difference whether they're paid or not. We heard testimony just now about the standard of care is still the same. The hospital has protocols, and therefore, why would they all of a sudden become an agent of the state based upon a declaration of emergency? And Ms. Johnson actually spoke with me before the meeting and talked about, well, there are protocols. So not only is there a question of should this immunity be provided or limited immunity, but I have a question whether it can be. I can't imagine protocols that would be detailed enough to actually direct the manner and method in which healthcare services are provided. And it's my understanding, at least in agency law, that that's really what you have to be able to do in order for someone to really be an agent or at least to have what we call vicarious liability. So I think there's a real issue about should this be a policy that we're pursuing when we're having people who have existing insurance, existing coverage, and we're now having the state pick up that coverage? And number two, can we do that? Because I don't think the directives could be specific enough to actually create an enforceable agency relationship, regardless of the statute. Those are really my concerns I wanted to voice, and I didn't hear those questions really being answered by the testimony before.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Representative Widener.
Would we be on the same side of the fence if we just enacted OHSU healthcare to all private facilities?
Representative Cowan.
Or Tort.
Widener, no, we wouldn't be on the same side of the fence, sir.
Just checking. Thought we might be able to seek common ground on some real healthcare reform.
Did you have another question?
No, I missed his name and who he represents.
Oh, this individual. Could you repeat your name?
My name is, my name on my letterhead is first initial J. Michael Alexander. I go by Mick Alexander. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a member of their legislative committee.
Thank you. I missed that.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. With that, I am going. Was there anyone else here to testify on this bill today? Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3021, and we will open a House hearing on House Bill 3255.
Absolutely.
Let him get down there, and then I'll ask you to summarize that for us.
Yes.
Well, Representative Freeman is joining us on the other side of the table. If Mr. Molina could brief us on this bill, please.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3255 provides flexibility for emergency service public or private safety agencies in the areas in order to be in compliance. It prohibits county, city, special district, or 911 jurisdiction from penalizing these public or private safety agencies when they cannot meet their contractual obligation. It declares emergency, effective on passage, and there is a dash one before you that, bottom line, it adds staffing levels and jurisdiction clarity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representatives Freeman and Matthews, get a little different look at these folks here.
I'll give you my talking points. So you go ahead.
Thank you.
I'll let you arm wrestle as to who's going to start.
Here you are. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm State Representative for House District 50, which is the great city of Gresham. Before you today is a bill that I believe is necessary. I do believe that you'll hear testimony on both sides of this issue because there might be some amendments that need to be made to address some of the concerns, but some of the concerns are legitimate. I want to speak specifically about the Dash 1 amendment that may cause a little confusion, and then I'll try to clear that up as well. The purpose of the bill potentially is, as many of you know, there are contractual obligations oftentimes in our private ambulance services, different private entities. On those contracts, they're given benchmarks or standards that they have to make. Sometimes in an emergency situation, obviously, when there's a declaration of that emergency, it ends up being that it's impossible for them to make those mandates. And so this kind of gives us a little bit of levity and flexibility. For an example, I think during the winter storms, I think it would be hard to hold anybody to a response time during the winter storms and to hold them to the standard of 8 minutes or less when their response were all over the county and all over the city of Gresham. And yet they still fell under the same guideline for that response time. As a fire service professional, I know that we waited on scene for several minutes for them, but then again, our response was delayed as well, and I think we need to take that into account. Specifically, Representative Freeman will talk, and again, we have Paul Evans, policy advisor for the governor here as well. But specifically, the Dash 1 amendments had to do with staffing configurations, and I want to be clear that in the conversation I had with our ambulance folks, staffing configurations was, to me, at Multnomah County, we're required to have two paramedics in the ambulance. This configuration, in my opinion, should never be allowed to be one person in an ambulance responding, and I think for those of you that are in the EMS delivery service, you can see how that could be detrimental. However, I could see where, if times were bad and we had a declaration of emergency, that we might want to consider allowing that one EMT basic and one paramedic to be in that ambulance. And in return, it may even give us the opportunity or give the ambulance company an opportunity to staff a few additional ambulances for the area. I'm not saying that's what they're going to do. I'm just going to say that I'm open to that conversation. I do think to hold them to a two paramedic standard when it was hard enough getting people to get into work and the demands on their workforce were great as they were for all of us, I think we need to look at a way to create flexibility in the system and allow them without penalty. And so that's really what this bill is about, is so that there's a reduction of the potential penalties if they can't meet those demands that were given under contract.
on everyday normal circumstances in the event of emergency. So with that, I'll pass it over to my great colleague there and let him continue. Representative Freeman.
Thank you. Chair Cowan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Freeman, state representative from House District 2. In my previous elected life, I was a chair of an ambulance authority down in Douglas County. So I'm pretty familiar with how these contracts work, the agreements between county commissions and ambulance service area providers work. The idea of this bill and the concept behind it is to make sure that in a time of emergency, a state-declared emergency only, that we don't punish folks for doing the right thing and trying to help. As we all know in our communities, none of us would have enough resources available to take care of a huge emergency in our districts. What this bill, the intent of this bill is to do, is to allow people from other areas to come into our area and help us without having to worry about their contractual requirements in their own districts, in their own ambulance service areas. We all know that we're stronger as a group than we are individually. The idea, and we'll continue to work on this, there's a few concerns around staffing levels and making sure we have the wordage just right. But the idea is a sound idea, and we need to keep trying to focus on what we're trying to get accomplished here. This bill, if we get it just right, will ensure that agencies are making the decision to respond to state-declared emergencies without the worry of how it's going to affect their contractual requirements. Paul's going to talk a little bit about this, and I don't know how often we have the problem, but I don't want to ever have the problem, and we need to make sure we have it ahead of time so we're not dealing with it during an emergency. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and members of the committee here. I am Paul Evans, policy advisor to Governor Kunkowski for Emergency Services, and I'll drill down to the who, what, when, where, and why. At first blush, this is a bill that would be dealing with something that hopefully never comes to pass. But the context of my world, at least, is this. With the ongoing budget climate that we have, with the ongoing mobilizations that we have, with the ongoing uncertainties of a number of factors having to do with local government's abilities to meet some of the responsibilities for public safety, we're trying to use this session to make sure and batten down all the particular hatches getting ready for the storm ahead. One of the outstanding issues was, in those rare cases where there is a governor's deck for a specific catastrophic event, that we weren't exactly, as the representatives were saying, punishing the good actors trying to do the best they can with what they have. I understand that there's going to be a work group, or at least there's going to be a potential a request for a work group. We want to make sure and get the language right on this. I mean, I think that's absolutely clear. But the reason we're getting into the swamp in the first place is to make sure that folks that may have less resources in the future, when called upon by the governor's office to respond, are not held, or at least having to pay a double penalty for helping on the one hand and then being punished for being helped. That's really what we're trying to do. As with all things, understand the wordsmithing part is important. Fortunately, there are people much smarter than me involved in this process, so I'm sure it will come out good. But the bottom line is, once we fill this little gap and make sure that folks around the state know that if they're helping or being directed to help during a time of crisis, that they're not going to be punished for doing that. That's really, I think, the objective key. So I'm going to stop there and try to respond to any questions you might have.
Might you explain for us, are you working on amendments, or you're anticipating a need for a work group? I want to be a little bit clearer.
What you guys?
Thanks, Chair Cowan. Thanks for the question. We were talked to today from a gentleman representing a group that had a few concerns with how this will actually play out and work, and he brought up a couple pretty good concerns, and we want to make sure that we all have the time to sit down and look and make sure his concerns are addressed or they're okay within the bill. So,
okay. Well, we'll... Representative Matthews.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Greg Matthews. I think, just Representative Freeman said, we probably have a few concerns brought to light that we want to address. I don't know if that will be by work group or just simply by amendment. I do think that, you know, from a fire service perspective, we currently have what we call 190 agreements, oftentimes the jurisdictions neighboring to us. So take Gresham for an example. We get a fire on the outside of our district. We have boring fire response. Sometimes they'll bring a water tender because water's, you know, necessary to fight fire, so they say. But the personnel is important too. But the
both of those seem reasonable.
Yes, they are. But in that and what generally happens there again is if you think about in terms of when we go to a conflagration, there's a wildland fire somewhere in the state of Oregon. Governor declares emergency and they ask for resource. Our chief may send a complement, one engine, maybe four people go. If they do that, he doesn't send it by closing a fire station and sending that. He'll send additional crew to go to that. And these 190 agreements, of course, we're leaving a hole in the city for that time that they're gone fighting that fire. I think one of the concerns is, you know, public versus private, sometimes it's done differently. The concern might be it wouldn't be profitable to do something this way, so would it be a chance? And I'll give you the hypothetical worst-case scenario because I don't think anybody's on board with this, and I've ran this by our private ambulance folks, and I know that they say not our intent, and I believe them. Let's say we have a partial structural collapse in a major mall, and that private ambulance company has jurisdiction in that. They have contract for that service. They send to staging four of their ambulances by request. They then, again, worst case scenario, they then assume that that gives them carte blanche because we have a potential declaration of emergency to do whatever we want in any other jurisdiction throughout the state of Oregon because we've now responded to the needs in that declared emergency. Again, I don't think, I know that's not where we're going. I know that's worst case scenario, but I think we want to make sure we narrow down the intent and file down the intent to make sure that what we're doing is encouraging people to be to do the right thing, not penalizing for doing the right thing, and allowing them to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And I think we're there. I think we're gonna be able to relieve these concerns relatively easily. I think what you'll hear is concerns, but not opposition, and I think that's a good thing.
We may be getting into prematurely into a little bit of detail.
We'll see.
We do have a few other individuals who would like to testify. I just want to make it clear to everyone, if we're going to go to a work group or seek amendments on this, it's going to be done need to be done very quickly. I would like to bring this bill back if we're going to be able to on the 16th, which is State Ambulance Day, and besides that, we're running out of time to get some of these things scheduled. So I'll hope that you'll be able to do that very quickly. I'm just sort of laying that out for everyone.
Sure. Chair Cowan, members of the committee. The potential need for a change was brought up to me right before the committee, and if I understand the situation right, I don't think this is a major deal. I think that we should be able to be getting there.
Great.
Thank you.
We have here Nan Heim, Sean Beard, and Randy Lauer.
Thank you, Chair Cowan, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association in strong support of House Bill 3255. The members of our association are the designated 911 emergency ambulance services and transporting agencies. Some of them are public and some of them are private. It just depends on what the cities and counties choose to do. As I said, we're here in support of 3255, and we have two members here of our association to explain our position, our president and vice president. Next to me, Sean Baird, who is the co-owner and manager of Woodburn Ambulance Service and president of our association, and then Randy Lauer, who is the vice president, and he is the manager of American Medical Response Northwest. Which provides the 911 ambulance service in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Josephine counties. And Randy is going to explain our position of support.
Thank you, and thanks for coming.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Nan mentioned, I'm Randy Lauer with American Medical Response and here on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. I'm also a retired 32-year veteran of the Coast Guard and Reserve, so before I start talking about the bill, I'd like to thank the committee's work for veterans and support of veterans around the state first. The OSAA represents members that include private ambulance service, public ambulance service, including fire department ambulances. And collectively, the OSAA members serve about 90% or respond about 90% of the EMS calls in Oregon. Personally, I've been deployed to 5 hurricanes, starting with Katrina and ending up last summer with Gustav and Ike, and Southern California to the fires a couple of years ago. I've seen all the bad things hurricanes can do. I generally don't have too much good to say about them. But one thing good about them is that they give us advance notice. In Oregon, EMS professionals, both public and private, have been planning for a no-notice event, such as an earthquake. In a no-notice event, we don't have the ability to pre-stage or pre-alert resources to evacuate people in advance of the catastrophic event. So we have to try to knock down as many of the obstacles to an immediate response that we can. A large-scale no-notice event will require an immediate response of every ambulance we can muster. And then the next thing we would do is we'd backfill them with off-duty personnel and equipment as fast as we could. But it's those initial couple of hours that are real critical here. We need relief during those hours from local standards that are typically designed to manage predictable, normal day-to-day activity, not a disaster. Representative Freeman and Matthews, I think, did an excellent job, and Mr. Evans, describing the merits of this bill. And in fact, Multnomah and Clackamas County, where we are the 911 provider, will typically, during an ice storm or a snowstorm, essentially right now, they'll forgive or relieve those standards for response times and staffing so that we can carry on through the disaster, the local disasters Representative Matthews described. What we're really talking about, what we'd like to accomplish with this bill, is that we can send resources immediately from one county to another county, or maybe across the Columbia River to Washington if there's a no-notice event like an earthquake. Though the counties and cities were pretty confident would give us the relief and the immunity or whatever you want to call it that we need, the time of a disaster is not really the time that we should seek permission or spend a lot of time receiving that permission, because it's precious time we really can't afford right then. I've worked on a lot of disaster plans, and the most effective ones seek to answer all the questions before they need to be asked, and that's really what this bill does. House Bill 3255 is a very important component of a statewide disaster plan, and it will ensure a faster response of emergency medical resources, and ultimately it will save lives. So on behalf of American Medical Response and the Oregon State Ambulance Association, I would urge you to support this bill with the necessary amendments that Representative Matthews talked about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Sean Baird, and as Nan said, I am a paramedic and own and operate Woodburn Ambulance Service, and also serve as the chair to the Regional Area Trauma Advisory Board for the area around Salem, surrounding counties. This is a topic that comes up for discussion quite frequently as we're doing emergency planning on a local and regional level, and that's really the level we're trying to address with this bill. In my case, when we look at the ambulance service providers around the Marion County area, since we're sitting here right at the moment, if there were a large event to happen toward the coast and they needed some help right away, the most likely scenario is that Woodburn Ambulance would send one ambulance, Rural Metro and Salem would send one, Turner Fire Department might send one. Each of those areas can afford to send a little bit, but that's a quarter of what I normally have to serve our area. So there's undoubtedly going to be some impact at home. What we're trying to address is that, as Representative Freeman and Matthew said, that we not be penalized for participating in getting that immediate response. And then that gives us a little bit of time to gear back up and backfill that position and get everything normalized on the home front.
Thank you. Any specific questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Livingston?
Good Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And while we appreciate the intention behind this bill, we think it's a bill that needs to be moved forward, but I think there are some concerns that need to be addressed. And specifically, while I think the fire and police, because they are totally public sector entities and it's required that you have Chapter 190 agreements to address some of the things that Representative Matthews dealt with. We also, by law, throughout the state of Oregon, have what you call, and I know that Representative Freeman's aware of this, ambulance service area requirements, which basically there's 36 different plans that are out there, certain requirements that need to be met within these plans, and they're really developed at the local level to address what the needs are specific to response times based on urban and rural areas. And one of the concerns that we specifically have with House Bill 3255 is to address, while the frequencies of this not happening a lot, this has to be a declared state of emergency. Let me give you an example. Let's use the tsunami example that occurs at XYZ town at the coast, initially you're going to get as many close available resources as possible. However, the way that ambulance service areas are developed, let's say they need to grab two ambulances from this county that the ambulance service area provider is countywide. So for that total county, they may have 45 ambulances, but they're providing two ambulances. The way this bill's currently constructed, it would abrogate those response times for the entire county during the declaration of the emergency. And while we all need, and I'm in agreement with Mr. Evans and the previous speakers, we all need to work together to provide those services and to address those problems, the one thing that'll happen when there is the tsunami at the coast, there's going to continue to be emergencies, whether it's the heart attack, whether it's a fire, whether it's the motor vehicle accident that occurs. And so one of the concerns that our organization has is that, as an example, especially for those large jurisdictions that provide ambulances on a countywide level, if they have 45 ambulances within their system and they only draw two, does it make sense to totally excuse response times for entire county that's not affected by the state of emergency? And I think most taxpayers in Oregon would say that that's probably not the intent of this legislation. But if you look at lines 7 through 8, it simply allows that during a state of emergency, you just wipe out all those response times. And so one of the problems that, and this is why these things get difficult and why, at least in the fire service, why you have monthly meetings with the fire chiefs, you work on these 190 agreements, you identify your resources ahead of time to make sure that while we all want to be there for the big one, during the big one, other emergencies throughout Oregon are going to occur. And so I think there needs to be a little bit of tightening and clarification on this language so that there's, and I certainly don't want to impugn anybody, because having worked with both private and public sector ambulance transport, I think most of the people do a great job within Oregon providing those services. But the language would allow for them to potentially, somebody that already has a local response time at that county level, to game that a little bit without some clarification of, whether it's on how many resources are being provided or whatnot. And so I think you need to really consider that as you move this bill forward, so that we handle the big one, but also handle the day-to-day ongoing operations, and so the taxpayer in Jackson County is still getting some assurances of a level of care when the tsunami is happening in Lincoln County. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions and appreciate this bill being brought forward.
Yeah, I actually do have a question.
You bet.
I'm a former county commissioner, and I served through several processes of orchestrating the alignment of the ambulance service area, or mm-hmm. ASA, and determining providers. And you come up with an average expected response time for given situations in a certain number of miles, but in the course of any emergency, and frankly it doesn't have to be a tsunami, I can rest assured if we have a tsunami in Lincoln County, we're going to be in trouble response time countywide, believe me. But
there are other challenges that present geographical challenges
Correct.
In response time, and I think that when Representative Matthews brought this bill, he was specifically thinking of weather-related delays mm-hmm. in time. We often, the provider needs to, if they're called out in the north end, then they may need to call up an ambulance, meaning on standby a little bit farther north than their normal service area, and there's a potential that on the far south end of their service area, there could then be a secondary event, and their time, they might not be able to meet their specified mm-hmm. response time. And I guess I'm, that's all I really am seeing in this bill is the attempt to address that. So I'm kind of confused as to what you feel that we need to add to it.
It's a good question, and to be clear about that, there's already provisions in my understanding in all 36 ASA counties for weather provisions, for road closures, so that each ambulance provider can petition the counties to say, hey, here's the situation, this is what occurred, it was a bad weather, the road's been closed because of a slide out, that's why we have a response time problem. However, with this bill, again, as an example, if one county only sends one or two ambulances, the way the bill's drafted, it abolishes anybody, whether it's private or public sector, from having to meet those response times, even though really they're only sending two ambulances to the nearest county, but it goes state countywide. No different than if you have a heavy peak period and you have ambulances that are busy within your county. It's the similar situation, but they are imposed for response time criteria. So really that's what we're trying to make sure is addressed is that the home front is still taken care for, and this bill at least provides for recognition that okay. those counties are handled. Did I make myself
okay,
clear
well,
on that?
We will send this to a work group, and hopefully we can find some satisfactory language. I freely admit that it's been a number of years since I've looked at an ASA plan, and I can't remember exactly what all of the provisions in it are. I wouldn't even begin to try. But I guess I do know that emergency providers, first and foremost, want to provide the quickest possible response to any given emergency, and we'll always try to do so if that's humanly possible. And so I would just charge the work group to recognize that as well. Representative Widener had a question. And
thank you, Madam Chair. Since I'm not involved in any emergency response, would it be an ambulance district, tying it to the district? So if you got a district that has two ambulances and they give up one, would that cover what we're trying to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I think that, you do have to look at availability and resources, and I think the previous speaker mentioned, and he's correct somewhat with respect to how many resources that can be available, whether it's for a major disaster or, a mutual aid situation. It all is incumbent upon the size of the entity. And so I think, yeah, that may be one way to address that and correct that. But I think it's unrealistic to think that, especially in an ambulance provider that provides ambulances for the whole county and only provides one, would be held to the same accountability as a small jurisdiction. Does that address your question?
My name's on this bill, and so I'm wanting to make sure we get it right. And if we just go to a district, because one district's sacrificing.
Representative, we're going to take it to a work group to get it worked on.
Okay.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just hope having been working on this since 2005, that we just get this done as quickly as possible, because time is just ticking away till something happens, and we can't afford to be lackadaisical about this. And I just hope we get this done and make it as easy as possible for response to be made, with respect to what, Bob, you've brought up. I would love to have 45 ambulances in my district. But in any case, I just think that the time is of essence here, and getting as much emergency planning in place as we can so that we are ready and prepared when something happens. So whoever's on the work group, work fast, please.
Okay. And I am assuming that you will be available to the...
Be happy to help.
All right.
And again, we support the concept. Just work out the details.
Okay. Thank you. So it appears that we do need a work group on this. Representative Matthews, you have something in mind here.
I think between Representative Freeman and myself and the stakeholders, and of course, I want to say again that nobody has said no to this. Everybody's said we're supportive. We like the concept. Let's move forward. I think expressing concerns is a good thing. It helps us do this right. So I would love to be part of the work group. If Representative Freeman would like to be part of that as well, since we both kind of co-sponsored this thing together.
If you two would, I would appreciate that. And if you'd keep us advised as quickly as possible, and we'll hopefully be able to bring this back in a timely manner and meet our time constraints. Okay? Great. Thanks. We'll close the public hearing on 3255. You can see I'm trying to speed up the process just a bit. And open a public hearing on 3059. Mr. Molina.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3059. It renames the Oregon Injury Registry to the Oregon Trauma Registry. It provides flexibility for the agency to create rules to how trauma data can be used. It conforms to current ORS form and language. Declares emergency effective on passage, and there are no amendments to this.
Okay, thank you. We have Bob Leopold. And I think, Sean Baird, you were interested in testifying also. If you'd like to come up at the same time, that'd be just fine. I think we're going to try to hold this to about 10 minutes or so that we have one other bill that we can get heard today as well.
I will attempt to be brief.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Cowan, members of the committee, my name is Bob Leopold. I am the Oregon EMS and Trauma Systems Program Director in the Division of Public Health of the Department of Human Services. And I appear today in support of House Bill 3059. Last fall, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of the Oregon Trauma System. The Trauma Registry was established shortly after that. The Trauma Registry is a database documenting the patient care provided by the trauma system. However, the Trauma Registry does not exist in statute. It was created under the general public health powers of the state, and therefore, in trying to use the data in the Trauma Registry, the Attorney General has very narrowly defined the confidentiality provisions. The purpose of the trauma system is to improve patient care. Data in the trauma registry can be used to do that by going back and looking at the care of specific patients and reviewing it to see how it could be improved. You can also analyze techniques and procedures that are used to see if they can be improved. Recently, a respected academic institution proposed to do a research project which involved comparing the reviews of the Area Trauma Advisory Group with the hospital reviews. We thought it was an appropriate project. However, the Attorney General said we did not have authority to make the data available for this research project. We discussed this with the State Trauma Advisory Board, with the Area Trauma Advisory Board for the Greater Portland Area, because this came out of the Greater Portland Area's Advisory Committee. Both of them support making this type of data available so we can do medical research and improve quality review. House Bill 3059 would establish the Oregon Trauma Registry in state statute, and it would authorize the Emergency Medical Services and Trauma Systems Program to write rules governing its use. The program would be authorized to make trauma data available to local and state public health agencies, to healthcare providers, and to medical researchers. For instance, an emergency medical service provider could review the data on a patient who they provided care for so they could work with their physician medical director to see if it was appropriate care. Statistical information could be provided to a county health department who are responsible for setting ambulance service areas. And medical researchers could, in specific circumstances, be provided data so that they could evaluate patient care methods and protocols. Now, we also recognize the importance of protecting patient confidentiality, especially as specific patients. This legislation would make the program responsible and give it the authority to protect patient information and also preserve the confidentiality of the quality review process. So, in closing, the department supports passage of House Bill 3059. Thank you for your time. If there are any questions, please let me know.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Mr. Baird.
Thank you, Chair Cowan and members of the committee. Sean Baird, speaking on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association and also my company, Woodburn Ambulance. A couple other roles that I play in the emergency medical services arena in Oregon are that I chair Area Trauma Advisory Board 2, along with Dr. Reed from Corvallis, and I'm a member of the State Public Health Advisory Board. In all of those arenas, wearing all of those different hats, the number one thing we're looking to do is improve the quality of clinical care that we're providing in the pre-hospital arena. This bill specifically would make some provisions for ambulance services to be able to access clinical outcome data that will help us directly turn that into improved training for the paramedics that are working on the street and handling emergencies every day. And we strongly support the language in the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I had a question of the first witness. If in the AG's opinion or his statement, were you not allowed to give that data because of confidentiality of patient data? And if you had redacted it, identifying information, would that have changed anything?
Representative Riley, because we don't have specific authority to release this, we could only release it if it was statistical data and not patient-specific. But without being able to examine patient-specific data, they were unable to do their research because they were attempting to compare outcomes of patients. Does that help?
A little bit. So we
could have provided them some statistical information, but they were trying to actually look at specific patient procedures in specific patients.
So even looking at specific patient data, you don't have to know who that patient was. Isn't that correct?
Sometimes, yes.
Okay.
If you're going to, if Mr. Baird's ambulance service at Woodburn provides patient care and then that patient is transferred to the hospital in Salem and then potentially to a hospital in Portland, you have to be able to track the patient all the way through the system. And so you have to be able to identify that patient in order to make sure that you have the same patient.
So if I'm understanding correctly, the purpose of this bill, then, if the trauma registry were clearly outlined in statute, then you would be able to write appropriate rules protecting confidentiality but still be able to get the information out that's required to do this kind of review and potentially improve training. Is that basically where we're going with
exactly.
this?
Exactly.
Okay.
Madam Chair, may I follow up again?
Yes, Representative Riley.
I'm a data analyst, okay? And I understand that there are ways to take out patient identification and still track data from one database to another by providing a new ID so that although each agency will not necessarily have passed along patient identification, you could still hook data together and give that to research agencies without patient identification. Is that something that you would be proposing to do, or would you still maintain that you need to be able to identify the patient?
Representative Riley, I am relatively new to Oregon. It's my understanding that the trauma registry has never been used in medical research because of the limitations put on it. We are trying to address that. I agree with you that you do not need to print the patient's name when you do this type of thing. I'm not a medical researcher, so I'm not going to pretend to tell you exactly what you need to do. It is our understanding that because of these limitations, Oregon has not been able to take advantage of the data in this database, even though we have nearly 20 years of information. And we're hoping to address that so we can make better use of this to improve patient care and to improve our techniques.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who would like to testify on this issue? Okay. Seeing none, we then will close the public hearing on House Bill 3059 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3083. Mr. Molina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3083 requires everyone to wear personal flotation device when using an inner tube on waters of this state, punishes individuals with maximum fine up to $360 per incident. There is a conceptual amendment en route clarifying that we're speaking of flowing public waterways of this state. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, I couldn't get to my page there, so I'll let you self-identify here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Adam Walsh. I'm with the City of Eugene. To my left is Deputy Chief Joe Zaludic from the Eugene Fire Department. We have some Dash 1 amendments to this bill that I hope you will take a look at. Should serve to show the intent of the idea that we have here. I believe that the original wording in our bill was a little bit broad. And the committee assistant does have copies of those amendments. I'd like to pass it over to the deputy chief, though, for his testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Zaludic. I'm a deputy chief with the Eugene Fire and EMS Department. And after over 20 years of emergency response, 16 of which as a responder and a supervisor for our water rescue team, our interest is to attempt to reduce drownings and near-drowning incidents from the lack of having a personal flotation device, specifically when inner tubing on a river or a stream. Many times it is a very economical way to seek get out of the heat and seek some recreation. And what we have found is that the law prevents a citation for an individual that is on an inner tube that is not connected to another inner tube. What has been done to kind of bypass this as a law is the inner tubers will tie long ropes between tubes, sort of towing each other, and this eliminates the appearance of being lashed together, which would make this an actual vessel and then require personal flotation devices. Unfortunately, we've experienced a number of very, I would say, public and high-level University of Oregon athletes over the last 20 years that have experienced this exact episode, which are tubing down the Willamette or McKenzie River. They fall off the tube and in relatively short order, 30 to 60 seconds, become extremely fatigued and the individuals would go under the water. My experience as a supervisor and a responder, as a surface rescue member, we have not been successful at resuscitating any individual that has gone under the water after falling off of an inner tube. Because of the response times and the time that it takes to get somebody from a river, we have not ever in the last 20 years had a successful resuscitation. Our only potential for having a potential rescue is to have somebody either clinging to a vessel or be able to float to an island where we can assist them to safety, or if their head is above water, assist them out of the predicament that they found themselves in. We believe that similar to a helmet law where every individual that's on a motorcycle on a community roadway has a helmet on, that every individual that is on an inner tube in a stream or a river should have the ability to have this personal flotation device on in the event, and it is very common that they are seen free from their inner tube and are found in current, which is very rarely swam without a flotation device. As anybody in a pool can tell you, it's relatively easy to swim across a pool, and I would say a majority, I know for a fact, a majority of the individuals that have drowned as a result of falling off of inner tubes were relatively new to the area, were visitors, or had never been in current and attempted to swim and fight the current. We know that it is very unsuccessful to try to teach somebody or get somebody not to panic once they're in a strong current without a life jacket. When you do not have a life jacket on and you're in a moving body of water and you are attempting to catch your breath and you're working very hard for that 30 seconds to 60 seconds, many times water will splash the individual in the face as they're going through a rapid, which causes coughing. They're unable to then continue swimming and they go underwater. Unfortunately, many of these incidents also include would-be rescuers that jump in to assist siblings, their children, or their friends. We believe if we had the jurisdiction and for the city of Eugene, we would look at doing something locally that would say from one area of our jurisdiction to the other, but it's not within our jurisdiction to enforce an ordinance that includes the state's property. I can tell you that we have had some incidents of drowning. This will not eliminate all drownings. We have had a pair of cousins that fell into a pond while fishing, that one drowned while rescuing the other. Very unfortunate circumstance. The positive outcome of that unfortunate circumstance is the community came together to turn that park and reduce many of the hazards, increase the opportunity for the public to be in the area, to hear somebody call for help, and the city has actually purchased that piece of property, has improved it to where it's become less of a hazard and more of a community asset. We believe that the action similar to what happened at that pond could be taken to reduce many of the drownings. And I can speak to the McKenzie and the Willamette Rivers directly, but some of the articles that you'll see are from the Santa Ana Rivers, the Deschutes Rivers. This happens all over the state, and it's usually a relatively inexperienced individual that has never been in current, falls off of an inner tube, and winds up going under the water. If you have any questions,
thank
I'll be
you.
Happy to.
Any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. Do you know what the, how does Washington and California have this, Idaho, any other states that have this type of legislation?
No, ma'am. Madam Chair, members of the community, that is not my understanding that Washington or Oregon have this as part of their legislation.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you know, because I saw you have woman drowns during rafting trip in Deschutes River, and we just passed a piece of legislation to require people to wear life jackets in a raft if it's class 3 and above rapids, just this legislation. And if you had inner tube, it wouldn't cover rafting anyway because the raft's not an inner tube. And I have a little bit of issue with it because there's some rivers that aren't a strong current. I personally do a lot of water skiing and will sit in a tube, and I think it'd be more of an age restriction, might be something a little more open to, because sometimes you want to lay out and get sun in that tube and end up with farmers. Well, I burn no matter what, so as you can tell by my face from this weekend. But
is there,
I mean,
a question, Representative?
An age limit would seem more appropriate to me than just banning tubing in current.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I agree. Similar to a helmet for an individual that is a minor that is riding their bicycle on the street, I do not see that as an obstruction or an option, and we are looking for any opportunity. But I can tell you that many of the individuals that are wind up inexperienced in the river might be college-age students, and I can look to the student-athletes that we were talking about earlier. All of them were on inner tubing trips, and but I would support anything that progressed us towards having personal flotation devices on individuals in the rivers and streams.
Thank you. Yes, I see. We have one more person to testify, but just for process clarity, you are looking at an amendment that would clarify some sort of rapidly moving water as opposed to still bodies of water?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, when speaking with Legislative Council, the original language was for waters of this state, which we felt was entirely too broad for what we're trying to accomplish. In speaking with Legislative Council, we had suggested as guidance, you know, language around flowing public waterway or something to that effect. Legislative Council came back and told us that streams and rivers would be the way to write that, and hence the amendment written as it is.
I guess for clarity, we have a -1 amendment before us that changes it from the waters of the state to a river or stream, but I thought I understood that there may be additional language changes coming. Is that correct?
No, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Esquivel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the percentage of drowning on an inner tube compared to all the rest of the drownings in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I cannot speak to that. I can tell you that my personal experience would say that it is a balance between rafts and inner tubes. Inner tubes tend to be the most vulnerable population because of their age, and their usually it's a very cost-effective way to get out of the heat.
Follow-up. Madam Chair, according to this, playing near water, this is children, 9%. Playing in a bathtub, 8%. We're boating, 4%. We're on a raft or an inner tube, 2%. That's 2007.
Thank you. Okay, if there are no further questions, we would also like to hear from Paul Don Hefner today, and we have about 4 minutes before they're going to make us wrap up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. I'll be brief. Current statute regarding boating excludes single inner tubes from the definition of boat. Therefore, we really don't have any statistics on injuries or deaths due to drownings related to single inner tubes. We simply don't track that information because they're not boating accidents. This bill, as you heard, would require the life jacket on all single inner tubes, all places, all times. And our primary concern was the broadness of that, the concern that that was all waters of the state rather than just moving waters. We would expect a great deal of negative feedback from the public if this was applied to all waters. The unintended consequence would be that people using these in swimming areas, near shore, on lakes and reservoirs, flat water, would be subject to citation for this, and I don't think our marine officers would relish trying to enforce that kind of a requirement in zones where people are relatively safe and they're just trying to cool off. If the intent, as we've heard, is to require it on moving waters where an inner tube is being used as a means of transportation rather than a water toy, then the bill should be amended to be more specific along the lines of the -1 amendment. From a water safety perspective, it's probably a good idea to require PFDs on single inner tubes if people are really using them as a means of transportation. If you're going miles and miles on a river, you're using it in effect as a boat or a raft, then it's probably a good idea. But on lakes and near shore places, a mandatory PFD requirement would seem to go too far. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Thank you very much for your input. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3083, and hopefully that gives the bill sponsors some direction to think about a little bit. Thank you. And we will close today's session of the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. Thank you.